presentation. So if I can give the first talk in the Chinese New Year. My talk will be about non-Fermi liquids and in particular holographic non-Fermi liquids using ADS-CFT. And this is work I've been doing with many people, including Hong Liu, John McGreevy at MIT, Tom Faulkner in Santa Barbara, and Gary Horowitz, Matt Roberts, and more recently, Nabil Iqbal. It's an ongoing work. So these are papers that you can look at. And you can also look at an earlier paper by Sung-Sik Lee, which sort of triggered the whole research project, and a paper by Zanan et al, who also worked on the same system. So let's get started. I will first talk about just the basics of Fermi liquids and non-Fermi liquids, what they are. And then I will turn to ADS-CFT. I will describe the background of the system that we look at. And then I will describe how to compute the Green's functions of probe spinner fields in this background. Then I will describe what we see. In particular, we'll see Fermi surfaces in these response functions of the probe spinner. And then we'll describe the scaling behavior of these of the Fermi surface. So as you move towards the Fermi surface, you'll see some quasi-particles, and their scaling behavior will be described by an emergent ADS-2 geometry which exists near the charged black hole in the bulk. And more quantitatively, one can do a small omega expansion, omega being the frequency measured from the chemical potential, and write down the Green's function in an analytic form. And finally, if time permits, I will have a slide about what happens at lower temperatures superconducting phase. And then I conclude. So any questions about the content page? So let's start. So one of the major differences between particle physics, how I learned it, and condensed matter physics is that condensed matter people study things at finite density. So what happens at finite density? A very successful theory is Landau's Fermi liquid theory, developed in the 50s, and later by Abrikosov and Kolotnikov in 63. We had an influential paper. Basically, all the metals that you learn in high school are described by Landau's Fermi liquid theory. So why is this? These gentlemen, Polchinski, Shankar, and Benfatto and Galivotti, they studied the RG flow, and they discovered that the Landau Fermi liquid theory is, in fact, an attractive fixed point modulo, of course, the BCS superconducting instability. So that explains why many materials are described by the Fermi liquid theory. So the Fermi liquid theory is, what is it? It's based on weakly interacting quasi-particles. So you see, this is momentum space. It's a nice round Fermi surface that you see now in two dimensions, Fermi circle. And the low energy excitations are here along this circle. And these are not the electrons themselves. These are dressed particles, quasi-particles. Using this idea that the original UV electrons and these quasi-particles are sort of one-to-one correspondence to each other, one can just basically immediately write down the thermodynamic and transport properties of the system. So this is a very successful theory. How do we see these quasi-particles? Well, one can compute this retarded correlator. It's a two-point function of the electrons. So this is the electron field psi at finite chemical potential and possibly finite temperature. And what you'll see here is these quasi-particles will appear as poles in this function. So this is typically how the function looks like. So this is the response function. Omega is the frequency measured from the chemical potential. And K here is the momentum. Vf is the Fermi velocity. And gamma is some self-energy of the quasiparticle. For this theory, the Landau-Fermi liquid theory, this gamma goes like the omega star squared. So omega star is the position of the pole. So you see from this that the self-energy is much smaller at low frequencies, which means that it's a stable particle. And an important quantity that one can also study is the imaginary part of this response function. So this is an important function because this is half of this function is what people can actually measure. These are the, I don't have the word on there, but. So these are the ARPAS measurements, experiments, which is the abbreviation of angle resolved photo emission spectroscopy. And what they measure is basically exactly this function, or rather this function multiplied by the Fermi function. So basically the negative omega side. And this can be effectively done in two-dimensional materials, of which the most prominent are the cuprates.
Experimental measurements, do they do it with some foreign particles injected?
Photons.
No. What I meant by that is that, you know, there is a material, I mean, what you, just running a little bit ahead, you will be doing a probe approximation.
Yeah.
So my question is, when the people do experiments, do they do also experiment in what can be interpreted as a probe approximation? Or it's just, you know, the material, and they look at the spectrum of quasi particles in the material that are native to the material?
I think our probe approximation is not much to do with this.
No, I'm not questioning. I'm just asking about the experiment. When people do the experiments, is there an analog of, like, they have to introduce something extra and measure the, you know, there is the Green's function of that, or they measure the Green's functions of the material?
I don't think they introduce something extra.
Okay, so then it's not.
Okay, any other questions about this historical slide? Good. All right, so this is wonderful. However, non-Fermi liquids exist. So what are non-Fermi liquids? It's something like saying an apple is not a banana. Unfortunately, non-Fermi liquids come, non-Fermi liquids come in many species. But there are common features. Sharp Fermi surface can still be present. There are no long-lived quasi-particles in general, but for example, the pole residue can also vanish. So some features are different. And something that you can immediately measure is the anomalous thermodynamic and transport properties of the system. So there are some examples here. The simplest example is probably the one-dimensional Wattinger liquid, where the interacting fermions can be described with a system of free bosons. Then there is the Mott insulator, metal insulator transition, which is, again, not described by the Fermi liquid theory. There are various heavy fermion compounds, and I think the favorite example is, of course, the high-temperature superconductors discovered in the 60s by Müller and Bednarz. These are based on copper oxide planes. And there is a revolution going on with superconductors, which are based on iron. Some more recent development in experimental physics. So these materials exhibit many interesting features. there is a so-called pseudo gap in the underdoped region, which means that the material is not in the superconducting phase, but you can still see a gap, which is weird. Fermi surfaces end in these materials, which is completely unusual. There are charge and spin density waves, and more back to these anomalous transport properties. The linear in T resistivity is has been measured. That was the biggest surprise in the 80s, because this is again nothing something that you can get from the Fermi liquid theory. Yes.
Are high TC superconductors said to be non-Fermi liquids? Are they that by default, or is this regarded as positive evidence in favor? I thought people still didn't really understand what the underlying physics was of this phenomenon.
Oh, this is just a measurement. You take this material, and it's not described by the Fermi liquid theory.
Right. So it's default, basically.
Yeah.
It's not a Fermi liquid, so
yes.
Okay. That's all. There's nothing more to it than that.
I'm not seeing more. The talk won't be about high-TC superconductors. I wish it was, but okay. So this is just to show you that there are some materials or systems which are non-Fermi liquids, and the question is there an organizing principle for this variety of different materials? And the question I'm asking today is, can ADS-CFT help? So any questions about this slide? Good. So okay, so the ADS-CFT correspondence. So this is just a lightning review of the facts that I'm going to use today. So it relates a certain d-dimensional conformal field theory to a string theory in one dimension higher, in asymptotically anti de Sitter space, for which the metric I've given here. The conformal symmetries of the field theory are related to the ADS isometries, and the global symmetries in the CFT become gauge symmetries in the bulk. And we've been most interested in the large end limit of these field theories at strong coupling, which is just mapped to classical gravity, which is where we will study the system. And finally, finite temperature in the field theory will be related to placing a black hole in ADS at finite temperature. And sort of a new thing of this research project is putting finite chemical potential, putting the field theory on finite chemical potential is basically related to charging the black hole. So you turn on electric charge, and that's the system that we'll discuss. Okay, so what is the geometry in more detail? So first of all, we will study a relativistic CFT with some gravity dual and a conserved U1 global symmetry that you can think of fermion number, but it's not necessary. Bosons can be charged under this U1 global symmetry as well. The action that we'll consider in the bulk is this. So this is just the Einstein-Hilbert action with some negative cosmological constant, and there is the Maxwell term. And here is the charged black hole solution. So the metric is basically just this, modification of ADS four, I guess, in this case. So the F function vanishes at R equal 1. So that's the location of the horizon. And there is an electric, there's a gauge field turned on in the bulk described by this function. Okay, so any questions about the geometry? This describes this charged black hole.
Why are you close to
here? Well, you can scale the more general form of the function is something like 1 plus probably something like q squared over 4. And then you can scale this. So when you wanna, you can scale. There are scaling symmetries in the background, and we've been using the symmetries to set some of the constants to particular values. It's just for simplicity. I didn't want to introduce more constants.
Sorry. So, did you say this is extremal? Or I'm not sure why you didn't write down a mass term.
Yeah, this is extremal.
Okay.
The idea is to study that at the zero temperature, as low temperature as possible, because that's when you can see sharp features. And then you can turn on small temperature. Okay, so what we're going to do is we'll introduce a spinner field in this background, and we'll compute the Green's function, the two-point function of the spinner field, and see what happens. So how do we do that? So what is the action for the spinner? This is just the usual action leading to the Dirac equation. And there's a universality basically for computing the two-point function. We will not need to know about the interactions. The results for us will only depend on the charge of the spinner, of the probe spinner field, and basically the conformal dimension, or if you wish, the mass in the bulk of the spinner field. So there's a prescription how to compute this response function of the spinner. You just have to solve the Dirac equation in the bulk. Space-time. At the horizon, you have to impose infalling boundary conditions that will correspond to computing the retarded correlator. And finally, you have to expand the solution at the boundary, and you discover that after some rescaling, so we can get to the spin connection, and an appropriate choice of gamma matrices, you discover that you can compute the Green's function by just taking the ratio of these coefficients in front of the two turns, two power laws. So this is just a generalization of the scalar, how one does this in the scalar case, that we have to deal with more indices. Do you have any questions about this? So let's see what we get. So we will see Fermi surfaces, and here are two plots about this. So I've chosen the constants here, the charge of the spinner to be just one in some units, and the conformal dimension to be 3 halves, meaning that the mass in the bulk is just zero. And I've set the momentum to 0.9 units of the chemical potential, and this is frequency, and this is just the Green's function itself. And this is the blue line is the real part of the Green's function, and the orange line is the imaginary part, that's the response function. And so what do we see here? We see a giant hole. It has some, it's on the lower half plane, so it's not a drug out here. And if you increase the momentum, then it turns out that this pole moves to the right and crosses zero frequency. And when it crosses zero frequency, this is the picture that we have. So this is the approximate location of this Fermi surface in this case. Above this Fermi momentum, you just see a bomb. Okay, so this is weird. This is some kind of particle hole asymmetry. Below the Fermi surface, you have a peak. Above this Fermi surface, you just see a bump like this. It's interesting. You can measure the scaling of this peak as you approach the Fermi surface. This k perp is just k minus kf of Fourier from the Fermi momentum. And you can compute this exponent z, which turns out to be, in this case, 0.09, some irrational number. Which, again, for a Fermi liquid, this is just 1. And what I said earlier is the bonds for k larger than kF. And the Fermi, there's a scaling behavior that you can test. The Green's function is symmetric under this transformation by lambda. So this is a non-Fermi liquid. Okay.
Yes. You're not going to say that AdS4 is a non, AdS4 with the U1 charge is a non-Fermi liquid. What you actually did, you introduced weakly interacting fermions, yeah, which interact with a strongly coupled
particle. Yeah, sure, sure. So what?
And so the quasi particles, what you are finding are the quasi particles due to the stuff that you introduced.
That's right. So you can summarize this in this Feynman diagram, basically.
And Pulchinski and
Pulchinski and Common Faulkner.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. But so at this level, we don't know how this works. This is just numerics. You're just solving a very complicated differential equation. So at this level, we don't even know why these things happen, why there's a scaling behavior. So let's just.
And all of this was at mu equals zero so far?
No, this is at mu equal square root of 3.
But the value, the chemical potential doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. That's the only scale. The temperature is zero.
So KF is expressed in terms of it's dimensionless because,
yeah,
there
because
is
it's
mu dependent there.
Yeah, exactly. So
KF over mu.
That's right.
Is it? It looks like there's a lack of smoothness at the zero point. Is that real or is that a numerical glitch or? At the zero point, it looks like it's not entirely smooth.
Yeah. Here? Yeah, there's a non-analyticity there, which you'll see later from the formulas.
And you have confidence that you numerically handled that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to use, 300-digit numbers if it's mathematical, but it took a couple of months to figure this out. I mean, these numbers don't come for free. So this is just a black box right now. We have to dissect this this machine, which gives you these functions. And for that, we have to look at the geometry again. This is, again, this charged black hole geometry. And here is a cartoon picture. So this is the radial coordinate, r. And the horizon is located at r equal 1. And so what happens here in the UV, this is just AdS4. But at the horizon, if you use an appropriate scaling, then you'll see that there is an AdS2 I-beam. So the geometry is very close to the horizon. It looks like AdS2 cross just flat space. Okay? So AdS2, that reminds you of AdS-CFT again. So you can just say that this gravity in AdS2, this is dual to some unknown 0 plus 1 dimensional CFT. We will call this I of CFT. How can you compute the Green's functions? You just use the usual AdS-CFT prescription. At low frequencies, the UV, the parent theory, is controlled by this IR-CFT that one can compute analytically. And each operator in the UV, this O, is associated to a family of operators labeled by the Fermi, by the momentum in the IR. So this is a correspondence. And conformal dimension in the IR theory is governed by this quantity, this mu, which basically depends on the conformal dimension of the probe spinner field, the momentum of the probe spinner, and the charge of the spinner.
So that momentum is in R2.
That momentum is in perpendicular space in R2, that's right. And so you can compute, this is basically the conformal dimension, delta is the conformal dimension, this one half was this quantity in the IR ADS2, in the IR CFT. And then you can compute the Green's function in this IR CFT, and it just turns out to be some complex number times omega to sum to this to this power. This is an irrational number.
So what's Q?
Q is the charge of the probe spinner. And yeah, so delta is just delta minus 3 half is just the mass here in the box. So we will see how this IR CFT is connected to the UV, and we'll be able to write down the Green's function. For this to happen, we have to study the low frequency behavior. Otherwise, we cannot say much about the Green's function.
So, presumably, if there is some range in which the conformal dimension becomes imaginary, right? Is there understanding which would signal breaking the unitarity of the infrared?
That's right. So if you take charge of the spinner field to be large, then you will indeed see. So this becomes imaginary, and then in the this IR CFT. Something goes wrong. However, nothing goes wrong in the whole system. Right. And what you see is that the Green's function is logarithmically periodic. However, the poles never move to the upper half plane, as opposed to the if you put a scalar field in the bulk in a similar fashion. Mm-hmm. And when this becomes imaginary for a scalar field, that's exactly when the superconducting instability happens. But for the fermion, it does not happen. So I think what happens is that the fermions still come back, react on the bulk, and then they turn this radius into a Lipschitz geometry, and that will resolve this instability. I think this is described by Sean Hartnell and Ochinski in this paper by a couple of months ago. Okay, good. Any other questions?
So when you say the charge is large, is that again somehow in comparison to the chemical potential? I mean, is this a problem if I fix the charge in the Lagrangian and I adjust the chemical potential, am I always going to run into this problem at some point, or what you were just talking about?
That's right.
Can I run into it at low mu or large mu? I couldn't tell.
A large mu.
Okay.
Yeah, so these here, Q and delta, these are just parameters for us, but these presumably come from some string theory compactification, so there's a discrete set of Qs and deltas that you can choose from. But since I didn't want to study that, I'm just taking this as parameters.
There are no constraints on K, right?
K can be anything here. That's right. You can turn on the magnetic field and then you might get some constraints, but here K is just a real number. Okay, so how do we use this ADS2 and this ADS2 Green's function to compute the full Green's function? So we, as I said, we studied the low frequency behavior of the Green's function. So this is not straightforward, because if you look at the differential equation, these omega-dependent terms will always dominate near the horizon. So what you need to do, or what you can do, is you separate the space-time into a UV region at large R and this ADS2 cross R2 IR region. And then you perform the small omega expansions separately in these two regions and match them at the overlapping region. And so the result is this complicated looking function. So what are these constants? I will explain this in a minute. This GK of omega is just this IR Green's function that I mentioned earlier. I had this probably I should write it up here. So this G, curly G, is some complex number depending on the momentum times omega 2 nu. But this is at zero temperature. At finite temperature, this is a slightly more complicated function. And this G is the only thing which is complex in this expression. So all these constants, A plus minus 0, 1, et cetera, these are all K dependent but real functions. And these are in general hard to compute. So these you have to do some numerical computation to get this.
So because nu is in general non-rational, pretty much arbitrary number. So does it so which means that there must be some scales that enters into the problem. Right. Besides the chemical potential.
Yes, it's messed up here.
That scale that enters, is that the scale at which you are doing the matching in the overlapping region, or it's really an intrinsic scale rather than?
Could be the temperature, for example.
No, but we agreed that we're doing it at zero temperature, right? I thought your result is at zero temperature.
This is a finite temperature. This is a finite small and finite small omega and finite small temperature result.
Okay, so then let me rephrase my question. So that answer is independent on how you do the matching in the overlapping region. Just to make sure that it's not the scale that you introduce by hand. If I change, so what you were saying, if I understood correctly, you're solving equations in the infrared and in the UV, and you do separate omega expansions in them, right?
Yeah.
And then you want to glue them.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle. So my question is, if I change where you glue them, will the answer change?
That's so that's governed by omega. You basically you rescale the radial coordinate by omega. So you introduce a new radial coordinate.
So what you're telling me is that I have to glue it at a particular scale set by omega.
So this would be your new x coordinate, which will be the coordinate of this ADS2 region.
And if I don't do that, then the answer will depend on exactly how I glue them. I mean, what is the reason that I have to glue the UV and IR region at the scale?
Is it? Yeah, I don't have a slide. Yeah, so there is a. I mean, yeah, definitely you can put here anything. Right. So you can put here P or something else, but then you'll have here some other function in front of this.
Right. So I would like
you
to,
have
so ideally that's the way how you would see whether this anomalous dimensions that you see is a result of some and a scale associated with the system rather than a cutoff, some sort of cutoff dependence. Right. I mean, it's really not a cutoff because
it's,
you do it.
Yeah, it's not a cutoff. Yeah, maybe I can show you after the talk how the scaling goes. I don't have a slide about this.
Okay.
Okay, so this is the result of the matching for the Green's function. And let's analyze this, how this function behaves in various cases. So first of all, how do we see the Fermi surfaces? Let's just suppose that for some KF, so remember, these constants depend on the momenta, on the momentum. So let's suppose that for some KF, this A plus zero constant vanishes. So what do we see then? At small omega and small K perp, which is K minus KF, this function, this complicated looking function, can just be rewritten in this nice form. So there is just some constant in the numerator, and K perp is coming from the Taylor expansion of this function. This omega term becomes this second term here, and finally, I'm skipping the higher order terms. This term is written here. Okay, so let's just plug in this zero temperature IR CFT Green's function. So this CK is the only thing which is complex in this expression. And nu is just, again, given by this simple formula. And it turns out that if you set m to be 0 and k to be roughly 0.9 and q to be 1, then you get the exact same functions that I plotted, that I shown you before, is which came out numerically. So this is this quasi-particle peak that we've seen before. Okay, so the motion of the pole in the complex plane for this particular case when nu is less than 1/2 is just basically a straight line. So as you increase, so this is the complex omega plane, and this blue is the path of the pole. So as you increase the momentum, the pole moves to the origin, and then there is a branch cut here on negative imaginary axis, and so it just moves to a different sheet, and you won't see the pole anymore. So that's why above KF you only saw a bump and not a peak. And in this case, the omega dependent term in the numerator doesn't really matter, since nu was less than 1/2. So at small frequencies, this term dominates, and the Green's function is just given by this simple formula. And okay, so here are just the details of this formula. So the location of the pole can be computed, and this is just given by k perp to some power z, which is again some irrational number. The self energy divided by the location of the pole is a constant, and the residue vanishes as you move to the Fermi surface, unlike the Fermi liquid case where it's just constant. Okay, let's look at the other case. What happens if this IR CFT dimension becomes larger than 1/2? So probably I should write it up here again. So this nu was something like the mass of the spinner in the bulk plus momentum squared minus the charge of the spinner squared over 2. So let's suppose that this nu is larger than 1/2. How does the pole move? So in this case, you cannot neglect this linear omega term, because here omega has a bigger power. So then the pole will move in this way. It will approach the origin with a much smaller self energy, and then it will leave again the origin. But you see that there is an asymmetry in the picture. So this is again unlike the Fermi liquid theory, where the situation is completely symmetric. The constants are given here. So here the pole is just moving with a constant Fermi velocity. So that is similar, that is the same as the Fermi liquid theory. However, the asymmetry is different. The residue is constant again. So that's again a similarity. So these are the two cases that we discovered. Do you have any questions about these cases? So what happens when we set nu equal 1/2?
So is a quasi-particle picture. So this pole, it's not clear from your formulas whether the lifetime is much larger than, depends, I guess, on nu sub k, right?
Yeah, so from this two-point function, we just see, so basically what I'm saying is that this imaginary part is much smaller in the second case than the real part.
So it behaves like more like a quasi-particle.
Yeah. Than the first case, where it's just the ratio is a constant, so it's moving in a straight line, so where it's marginally stable.
And that constant is for the one, there is no hidden logic.
There is absolutely no hidden logic. Yeah. I mean, yeah, So this is an actual numerical. Mm-hmm. It's not a cartoon picture. It's how it moves. And there is no this angle in particular. This can be anything. So it can go here. So there's just no way to make it small.
Now, is this magic number 1/2 somehow related to relevant forces, irrelevant deformations of this infrared CFT?
That's right. So when this mu is equal 1/2, then that's exactly marginal.
Okay.
And so this is the case. What is this? Yeah, let's suppose that mu is 1/2. Then in this case, the Fermi velocity goes to zero as we approach mu equal 1/2. But this CK function has a pole, so it's canceled. And what you're left with is a logarithm. And this is the form of the function. And so this function, people have studied this function for a long time because this is the famous marginal Fermi liquid Green's function introduced by Varma approximately 20 years ago. And this was introduced to give a phenomenological model for these high temperature materials in this region above optimal doping where you see this so-called strange metal phase. Okay, just one, maybe two more words about this diagram. So this is just the temperature of the phase diagram, and this is the hole or doping. You have to introduce holes into the system, otherwise zero doping is just an insulator. So Varma introduced this function, the exact same function to describe basically the linear in temperature resistivity of these materials. I'm not talking about the conductivity or resistivity in this system, but it's an ongoing work. And it turns out that if you choose these parameters, then you do get a linear in temperature resistivity at small temperatures. So that's consistent. So what other aspects do we see in this system? So there's this particle hole asymmetry that I talked about earlier. One can write down a formula for the Fermi velocity as an integral in the radial direction. Your question about the imaginary IR exponent, so this leads to a log periodic behavior of the correlation function.
CFT in condensed metal, right?
That's right.
Do they observe something?
I don't think so. I did a Google search once, but I found nothing. I found stuff about earthquakes and very slow periodic behavior.
How about Polchinski model? Does he see that in his kind of holographic model with weakly coupled probes? Does he have?
I can't remember.
I don't remember
that, but I would say no.
Okay.
In the scalar case, it's just it just condenses, so then you get this hairy black hole, mm-hmm. and then you don't see this anymore.
But he's not doing for the fermion self-energy.
Mm-hmm. So these fermions are constantly pair created, and they just leave the rising Nordstrom black hole, but since it's in ABS space, they bounce back. Mm-hmm. And somehow you, at finite n, presumably you'll have finite density of fermions in the bulk, and that modifies the geometry, mm-hmm. for sure. But yeah, the effect is very small, so I'm not sure. There is a limit free fermions that I did not talk about. You can set the parameters to obtain free fermions. This is probably the most complicated way to describe a free system. And then you can also study the scalar case, and then you discover a charge. You discover a new instability for the charge scalars at the finite momentum. There is an interesting play going on between statistics and stability. So if you look at the scalar, then you do see the poles going to the upper half plane. You never see that for the fermions.
That's a different thing.
Yeah,
no, I'm just referring to a finite momentum instability for the scalars.
So can you say a couple more words? So this is just a charge scalar, right? Including the back reaction.
It's just a large scalar.
In the large charge limit.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then the point is that that's case by new instability, you mean the instability that occurs at finite momentum.
That's supposed to, people look at zero momentum instability before.
And that instability occurs earlier, or how is this instability compared to?
Yeah, we look at that. It happens after the zero momentum.
Okay. So zero.
I would love to get something like charge density waves, but.
Okay.
And there is a story at finite temperature. So I talked about this branch cut, the negative imaginary axis. So this dissolves into a series of poles at finite temperature. And we have formulas for small omega and small temperature, how the Green's function looks like. One can study various oscillations in various thermodynamical properties or magnetic moment of the system, and people have been doing that. Yeah.
So for the finite temperature, so you're saying you see how the branch cuts turn into a pole and a liquid?
Yeah, so it's complicated.
Okay,
but I don't have it.
Okay,
right. That's here, but I can show it.
Okay.
Basically, what happens is. Okay, I have space here. So this is the convex omega plane. And at zero temperature, and when nu was less than half, then you had a branch cut here. And the poles then moved to the origin and then disappeared on some other sheet, or perhaps not. They just continue here. And at finite temperature, instead, what you see is just a series of poles. These are, roughly speaking, separated by something, by T or something.
Yep.
And then the pole moves here to the other side. Or so the interesting part was what happens when it, at zero temperature, it disappeared on a different sheet. So how does it look like? There is an interesting place. So basically, the pole just stops here. All the guys move down.
That's in your papers.
It's not in the paper, but I have nice movies.
Okay. Okay.
But so more interestingly, one can also compute the conductivity. So this is an ongoing work with Nabil Iqbal. What you see is that when you have this marginal Fermi liquid Green's function, that's exactly when you get 1 over T conductivity. So a contribution to the conductivity from this Fermi surface, which is 1 over T. So if you only look at this piece of the conductivity, then and you take the reciprocal, then you get linear and T resistivity, which is what you see in these high TC Coupe rates at optimal looping. Okay, so these are just some other aspects of the system. Okay, I have 5-10 minutes. I have one more slide about what happens at lower temperatures. So this is some more recent work we've been doing with Gary Horowitz, Matt Roberts. So here you introduce a scalar field or a boson in the bulk. So this is just some action. So this boson, this phi, is also charged. And what you see is that this scalar wants to condense and then turn this Riesel Nordstrom black hole into a hairy black hole. And one can consider plain symmetric ansatz for the solution, and you can solve the various functions numerically. And after you compute the background, you can again introduce a spinner probe in the bulk
just in a very similar way to what we've been doing in this talk, except now the background is more complicated because these G and chi, et cetera, these functions are not known analytically. Okay, so the spinor field, and so this is just the Dirac part, and it's a very natural thing to introduce a coupling between the spinor and this condensed condensed scalar field. So there are many kinds of couplings that you can introduce. Probably these are the simplest, but for these couplings to be gauge invariant, the scalar charge has to be twice as large as the spinor charge. This here, this zeta is the spinor. And you see I took the conjugate spinor here. And then I cancel the charge by adding a phi star. So what you see after you introduce these couplings, you see a gap. So here again, I have some pictures. The horizontal axis is the frequency. And basically, so one function here is at one particular momentum. So this guy here, for example, this is when the momentum is, let's say, 0.8. And this function here is when the momentum is 0.9. So as you increase the momentum, you get these different energy distribution curves. And you see that the pole, as opposed to the non-Fermi liquid case, it does not cross the origin in this picture. Instead, it turns back. And here you see that there is some mixing between positive and negative energy modes. So here, some small peak comes in and then turns back. So this is just the gap that you expect to see in superconductors. And here's just another picture, same phenomenon happening, except with a slightly larger coupling between the phi scalar and the spinor fields. Well, basically, what controls is how much scalar, how much hair the black hole has, and what these couplings are.
Yeah. Basically, the product of these two things. Here, I should say that this eta parameter doesn't do anything. So this only this eta 5 which creates the gap.
Because just the structure of the spinners, the eta parameter without the gamma function does not. So there's a critical value of eta 5 at which those red curves would just touch each other. Is that the idea?
Oh, these red curves?
Yeah. Oh. Is there some critical value of eta 5 at which those
things? When it's zero.
Pardon?
When it's zero.
Oh, when it's zero. Okay.
So that's just, then you just see the peak, roughly speaking, going through the origin and.
Okay, and the blue lines are the critical momentum value of which?
Oh, yeah. So, okay, that's a good question. So it turns out that in this particular background that I did not really detail here, between the blue lines, the spectral function, that is the imaginary part of the Green's function, it's exactly zero. And that's because instead of ADS2 in the bulk near the horizon, you'll have an emergent ADS4 space because the scalar has condensed. And it turns out that because van der conditions are also real, the function is just exactly zero here. And that ends here at the blue lines. But that of course is not true at fine temperature. And then, so this was only scalar condensation. So this is a sort of an S-wave superconductor. And then you can think of creating a P-wave or a D-wave superconductor by condensing vector field or higher spin fields.
And you do indeed see a D-wave gap. But that's, again, ongoing work. So let me just summarize. So we consider the charged black hole in ADS space. That was our background. And we added a probe fermion field. And we computed the spectral function of this probe fermion. And we saw Fermi surfaces. And these Fermi surfaces exhibited non-Fermi liquid behavior. And the location of the Fermi surface in momentum space, that's given by UV physics, as in real materials. However, the scaling behavior near the Fermi surface that is controlled by this IRCFT, which we described by this ADS2 region. And at low temperatures, there is a superconducting instability in these backgrounds. So instead, you look at hairy black hole backgrounds where scalar field condensed. And if you compute the spectral function in a similar fashion by introducing a probe fermion, then you see a gap if you have the correct coupling between the scalar and the probe field. So I think I should stop here. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Well, I guess David's around for a few more days.
Yeah, until Thursday.
Absolutely. For now, let's thank him again.